This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This is a moment for thinking about the importance of listening and being in the civic town square, trying to trust government, citizens asking questions, transparency of information. We are broadcasting today from the Boston Public Library, the first large free municipal library in the United States. This is a library of the future, but it's also infused with a mission that goes back to the very founding of the United States. Just to emphasize that future, I'm here in a satellite studio from our partner station, WGBH, which built this studio right in the new renovated library. We begin this hour with the news out of Syria. Days after a chemical weapons attack against civilians in the Syrian city of Idlib, the Trump administration has launched an attack against a Syrian airbase suspected of being the source of a sarin gas chemical attack against civilians in Idlib earlier this month.
Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched. It is in this vital national security interest of the United States to prevent and deter the spread and use of deadly chemical weapons.
Speaking from Mar-a-Lago, President Trump said the global community had failed to respond to the horrors of the six-year-long war in Syria, and he called on the global community to stand by the United States now.
Tonight I call on all civilized nations to join us in seeking to end the slaughter and bloodshed in Syria, and also to end terrorism of all kinds and all types.
And there are many messages coming from many different officials in the administration on what the position is regarding Syria. We can review the bidding a little bit. The reality of the U.S. position on Syria stands as this. First of all, there are now U.S. boots on the ground in Syria. They are fighting ISIS in Raqqa. A U.S. airstrike, as the president mentioned, has taken place against a military target, which was believed to be the source of the chemical attack in Idlib. Are we at war with the regime of Bashar al-Assad and ISIS simultaneously? And are U.S. forces in harm's way of Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons? With us is Missy Ryan of The Washington Post. She writes about the Pentagon, military issues, and national security. Missy Ryan, what do you think? Are we at war with Bashar al-Assad now?
Well, the Trump administration so far has framed this as an isolated retaliatory operation in response to the chemical attack that you mentioned. And so far, there's no indication that this will be the opening salvo of a larger campaign against the government of President Bashar al-Assad that would seek to unseat him. Now, we don't know what wheels are turning within the administration and whether or not there's going to be a full-fledged, not necessarily declaration of war, but new policy to oust Bashar al-Assad, which in some ways was the Obama administration's policy, but they never acted on it. And it would be a big surprise if it were, frankly, because the Trump administration has suggested up until the past 3 or 4 days that they actually were going to take a much more friendly line towards Bashar al-Assad than the previous administration. So as far as we know right now, this is a one-off. And we just have to wait and see if there's any additional strikes that follow.
But we don't know if the Idlib attack with sarin gas was a one-off, because really the headline here on the sarin attack is that after all that business years ago with the carting Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons out of the country back to Russia or some depot that was part of the on-site inspection regime, clearly Assad lied. He has sarin gas. There are still stockpiles. And there could be another attack. Could U.S. forces be targeted by an attack?
Well, I think that's a fair deduction, but there's another possibility, which is that they acquired the sarin since 2013 in some other way. And I know that that's something that the U.S. military officials that I've been talking to say is a possibility that they're also exploring. Clearly, you know, however they got it, whether they kept it after 2013 or they acquired new stockpiles of sarin or other deadly nerve agents, you know, it's in violation of international requirements. But the Syrian government since 2013 hasn't used these in the same way that they have just this week. So I think the hope is that it's a show of force, essentially, and, you know, something that the United States hasn't done. Obviously, in 2013, the Obama administration crept up to the line of taking a strike after the 2013 Ghouta attack, but it actually didn't follow through with that. And so their strategy is to show Bashar al-Assad that the Trump administration is different and that they're willing to take military action and hope that that has a deterrent effect.
Collectively, I'm going to use a little shorthand and call the national security team under Trump the generals, since most of them are former generals. And then there's Trump. Do they see eye to eye on where to go with this? Is there a strategy and a real plan on Syria right now?
I mean, again, with so much else in, with the Trump administration at this point, it's anybody's guess where the consensus policy position is. What we know is that Trump appeared previously to have been more open to endorsing the Bashar al-Assad to stay in power than the past administration, but that he was clearly emotionally affected by this incident. We also know that the U.S. military has been, and I think continues to be, somewhat wary of getting involved in the fight against Bashar al-Assad for reasons that have been laid out in the past by military leaders. And I don't think that that has changed dramatically, because the sort of fundamentals of their concerns regarding the possibility of confrontation with Russia and Iran and then the sheer scope of any military effort that would be required to unseat Bashar al-Assad haven't changed either. So I can't see this attack last night being connected to a clear Syria strategy. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, that is still being worked out in the new administration. And the timing was just such that this was something that they wanted to act on. And, you know, maybe the Syria policy will be influenced by this action and then the Russian and Syrian response, or maybe it won't.
Missy Ryan of The Washington Post. Thanks so much, Missy.
Thank you.
Now, to help us understand why Tomahawks and how sarin gas has changed the game in a six-year-old civil war in Syria, John Gilbert joins us. He's a senior science fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. He established the Chemical and Biological Operations Division in the U.S. On-Site Inspection Agency. He has training in how to respond to chemical weapons, including sarin gas. He says this isn't the first time the U.S. has responded to a chemical attack with Tomahawk missiles.
There are a couple of instances. One occurred back in the 1990s when bin Laden and al-Qaeda were believed to have manufactured chemical weapons at a facility in Sudan. That facility was hit with Tomahawks, and information was later collected. That may not have completely deterred al-Qaeda from pursuing chemical weapons. And there are also strikes at some al-Qaeda facilities in Afghanistan that were believed to be associated with the production of sarin, which is a nerve agent.
Does the use of sarin itself constitute an escalation beyond the use of chlorine bombs, for instance, or mustard gas from World War I?
It absolutely does. Sarin is far more toxic than chlorine. And similarly with the toxicity of mustard, just a tiny amount of sarin can be fatal to a person who doesn't receive immediate medical treatment.
And in this particular case, what kind of delivery system do we suspect the Syrians used for sarin, and how would it have acted on civilians?
Well, it appears that two aircraft called SU-22 aircraft were used that either dropped bombs or shot rockets filled with sarin. The sarin vapor was released in the area where civilians were present, and apparently hundreds of them were exposed to dangerous concentrations within seconds. It can take minutes to tens of minutes for a person to actually die. Other symptoms that people experience, though, include loss of muscle control, and some of the victims who were videotaped were actually convulsing and obviously in great distress, not just with their breathing. There are also effects on eyesight and the ability to control bodily functions. So it's not necessarily an instantaneous death. It can take a very significant period of very serious discomfort.
And I think we should all have sympathy with the statement from President Trump last night that no child of God should have to go through such suffering under any circumstances. There's been plenty of suffering in Syria over the last 6 years that hasn't motivated much of a response as far as the United States is concerned. What would you say as far as a 59-strike Tomahawk missile attack as was described by the president last night, or his officials, his advisors, as a proportional response to this attack. Does that make any sense to you?
Yes, it certainly does. From what I've seen from a variety of sources, the attack was directed at a particular airbase about 100 kilometers from Khan Sheikhoun, the site of the attack. That airfield is the base for Su-22 type aircraft. It has a number of facilities to maintain them, launch them to conduct airstrikes, and there's a munition storage area that's also present where conventional or chemical weapons could have been loaded or stored. I think it was widely expected that after the 2013 sarin attacks and after Syria signed on to the International Chemical Weapon Convention, that they had notified the world of what they had and that they had taken steps to get rid of it. Inspectors did operate in Syria for several years after that to confirm the removal of the chemical weapons. One of the only places that I understand they were not able to visit was this particular airbase.
Which really casts an indictment on the entire on-site inspection process. I remember the inspections and the carting away of all those chemical weapons agents that went back to Russia. The SU planes that you describe are Russian planes, the U.S. Tomahawk missiles. The irony here is, don't the U.S. and Russia have sarin stockpiles somewhere, even though these are banned weapons?
The U.S. and Soviet Union, now Russia, had very significant stocks of sarin and other chemical weapon agents. Under the Chemical Weapon Convention, though, those are in the process of being destroyed. The United States stockpile is over 90% destroyed, and Russia has been working for a number of years and has probably eliminated a significant portion, probably more than half, of their holdings.
Now, I know you have security clearances, and you may not be free to talk about this, but do we believe now that Syria, Bashar al-Assad, is holding on to weapons of mass destruction that could include just about anything at this point?
I'm not aware of any nuclear weapon capability that Syria might have on their own. Biological weapon capability is certainly possible, but there's been no indication that Syria has been pursuing that. There have been several previous cases where chemical weapon material was used to attack civilians. So I'd say at this point, the consensus is that Syria has chemical capability, but not biological or nuclear.
John Gilbert, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
John Gilbert is a senior science fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.